Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Why don't we start with some baseball? And a degenerate on November 6th, Steve Cohen's deal to purchase the New York Mets became official. And that was billed as the start of a new era for the Mets. The old days of being a jacked up, embarrassing organization were over. Gone are the days of Mr. Met flipping off fans and little kids lighting the manager on fire.
Terry, show some emotion, you old ass, silly ass man.
Yep. Good days are coming. Everything's going to change. No, it's not. In fact, things obviously are going to get a hell of a lot worse before they get any better at all, because this morning, the Mets fired their GM, Jared Porter. And it was not part of some house cleaning that Cohen started when he bought that team. Porter was actually part of the new regime. He was supposed to be a part of the solution, not the problem. And no, he was not fired because he had not been active enough in free agency or the trade market. In fact, he was killing it there. No, he got broken off because he was too active on his cell phone. And not too active in a clickbait sort of way or addicted to Instagram sort of way. But believe this, dude could not put that phone down for any reason. How active? How active, you ask? Well, let me read the first sentence of a report from Mina Kimes and Jeff Passan that dropped last night. Here is how the piece opens, and I quote, New York Mets general manager Jared Porter sent explicit, unsolicited texts and images to a female reporter in 2016, culminating with a picture of an erect, naked penis, according to a copy of the text, history obtained by ESPN, end quote. Bam. There you have it. Right in your face.
Right in my face.
That sums it all up right there. Now, I know a lot of you probably did not want to start your day by hearing about Jared Porter's erect, naked penis. I sure as hell didn't want to start my day by talking about that. I probably should have said right off the top that this next story is graphic in nature, so you knew that going in. My bad. I'll make up for it now by letting you know it's about to get worse, so much worse, because this creep just would not stop. And let me get this out of the way right now. Mets are going to Met, and apparently that is the law of the land. It doesn't matter who owns that team or who they hire. This organization is bound and determined to find itself in the middle of one revolting incident after another. Hell, Steve Phillips can't believe a Mets GM would act this badly. So here's the next part of the report. Quote, the woman, a foreign correspondent who had moved to the United States to cover Major League Baseball, said at one point she ignored more than 60 messages from Porter before he sent the final lewd photo. End quote. 60 freaking messages and one lewd photo. Sidebar. Lewd is an amazing word. Unfortunately, it often refers to creeps pushing out unwanted personal porn. But if there's any way to get beyond that, and I'm not sure there is, lewd is a great word. It's just too bad it describes that sort of thing. Anyway, according to ESPN, Porter, who was working for the Cubs at that time, met the correspondent in an elevator at Yankee Stadium in June of 2016. It was their only in-person meeting. They exchanged business cards. They talked about international baseball prospects. And Porter, that's not what they mean when they say everybody should have an elevator pitch at the ready. According to the report, Porter contacted her that afternoon. And before the day was over, he texted her three times asking her out for a drink. Let me jump right in there, too. Friendly piece of advice, three times in the same day, is absurd. Obviously, it's not the most wildly inappropriate thing this creep did in the grand scheme of things, but if you're asking somebody about getting a drink three times in the same day, that's way too many. I guarantee you that person saw the first text about a drink. They don't need to see a second or a third. The reason why they haven't responded is because they don't want to get a drink, not because they didn't see the text or didn't receive the text. It's that simple. According to the woman, at one point, she did agree to meet for a drink because she thought that he was offering himself to be a source for her reporting. She couldn't meet that night, but that did not stop Porter, who sent her an unsolicited selfie with the message, "Like?" Let me answer that question for you, J-Man. No. Unlike. In fact, hate. As with all of this stuff, if you're not getting a hell yes, then it's a hell no. But Porter, being the creep that he is, just kept right on. A few weeks later, he texted her to say, quote, "Why aren't we hanging out?" According to ESPN, quote, Porter asked whether the woman remembered what he looked like and said, quote, "You're so pretty. Do you have a boyfriend yet?" He sent a selfie and said, "It can be me." Again, you aren't hanging out because she doesn't want to hang out. But he wouldn't stop. Somewhere in that exchange, he sent three pics, quote, including the first of several that would show a man lying on a bed with a bulge in his pants, end quote. Porter, dude, the hell is wrong with you? You're texting a photo of a bulge in your pants to a reporter. What's going on in your head? She's a professional, and you're sending her that crap. When the woman realized the sexual nature of his communications, she stopped returning the texts. And according to the report, this began a pattern of unsolicited messages from Porter with zero responses from the woman, 62 in total. Again, allow me to jump in here and say, if you're sending 62 messages to somebody who is not responding, that is not persistence. That's harassment. Like, I don't even care what the content of the messages are or is. Even if the messages are dong free, and they're not, but even if they were, that's harassment. I mean, you know better, loser. But this guy was not done going full-blown degenerate. In fact, he was just getting started. He's a walking, talking Dateline to Catch a Predator episode.
How are you, sir?
Get a load of some of the messages he started to fire off. Quote, "Which picture do you like the most?" Quote, "Want to see more?" And then a message that was just a question mark. And then another message that was just a question mark. And then about 5 hours later, quote, "Hello, beautiful." About 90 minutes after that, "Is it too much for you?" About 2 hours later, "Where did you go?" Almost 3 hours later, at 2:03 a.m., quote, "I'm bored." I mean, this loser is about to go with something like, "I can't control my horny level.
I can't control my horny level."
Look, I know there are women listening right now who have received this kind of unwanted harassment. And I'm going to guess there are guys listening right now who have sent this kind of stuff. And the worst part is, the dudes who do this sort of thing are okay doing this sort of thing. And I'm telling you right now, do not think that I'm violating some bro code. Because if you're doing that crap, you're violating a moral code. Stop doing it. Again, don't confuse persistence with harassment. If Porter can't be better than this, at least you can. So here's one summary of some of the messages. Quote, "The day after the woman stopped returning his text, Porter wrote, 'Mad at me?' Later that day, he sent three more pics. The first was of a World Series ring that he won during his 12 years with the Boston Red Sox, with whom he had gone from intern to pro scouting director and won three championships. The other two were bed pictures of a man's clothed groin," to which he added a message, "Am I annoying you?" End quote. Damn it, Porter. Read the freaking room. You know if you have to ask "mad at me" and "am I annoying you," the answer is yes. She's pissed. You're the most annoying guy ever. And he still wasn't done. Here's yet another summary of the messages. At 2:44 a.m. one day, he texted, quote, "I want to see you." And then according to ESPN, quote, 7 hours later, he wrote, "Do you want to see me?" 3 hours after that, he said, "I'm sorry. At 10:59 p.m., I thought we could have some fun." And then on July 23rd, his fourth consecutive day of texting without a response, Porter wrote, "I'm a nice guy, you know." Later that day, he said, "Was it the pictures that made you mad?" That night, he sent another selfie. Dude, delete your own number. Throw away your phone. Just reading this crap is infuriating. I can only imagine what it must have been like to actually receive it. And if you feel like you need to send a message which says, "I'm a nice guy, you know you're a jerk." And he still wasn't done. Because in August, he texted, "I'll be in LA this weekend at the best hotel in America. Can you meet me there?" Yo, Jackwagon, what are you doing? She hasn't responded to you in weeks, and you're inviting her to a hotel. Look, man, I don't care if you're at the Four Seasons or a Days Inn. She doesn't want to see you, ever. But he still wouldn't stop. The following day, he texted her to say, quote, "You're missing out." Doubt that, Porter. And still didn't stop. He chased out with 17 photos, including one that was described in the report as an erect, naked penis. Yo, dude, are you proud of yourself? Because you shouldn't be, creep. If she hasn't responded to 60 messages, she is not playing hard to get. And if this guy couldn't have been any more Dateline to Catch a Predator, his explanation for what happened is truly moronic. When ESPN contacted him last night, he admitted texting her but denied sending the photos of himself. When told that the reporters had seen the selfies and other images, Porter said, quote, "The more explicit ones are not of me. Those are like, kind of like, joke stock images." The oh-so-hilarious joke stock images of erect penises that everybody knows and loves. Hilarious, Chief. In other words, that dong wasn't your dong. Why didn't you just say so? Yeah, hope that was worth it, loser, because I know it wasn't. And I know you lost your job because of it. And the fact that I had to talk about your junk or your fake junk makes me want to quit my job. Which so happens to be my dream job. You know, sort of like the dream job that you just had, spent your whole life working for, and just threw away.
Loser.
I don't know. Maybe Porter got his baseball GM mind frame mixed up somehow with his social cues. You know what I'm saying? You know, that whole make the deal at all costs? That whole, it's not how many no's, it's how many yeses, and all you need is that one big yes scenario? Yeah, well, that might apply to improving your ball club, but socially, it makes you a degenerate creep. She's not an assistant GM or an advanced scout. You aren't trying to Jedi mind trick the Brewers into giving you Yelich for a bunch of AAA lifers. You're not building out your farm system. Man, you're ruining and tormenting a poor journalist's life, jackass. Hey, yo, if you're bored at 2:30 in the morning, take a sleeping pill. If you're texting out pics of your big unit, it better be Randy Johnson.
Hey.
I would imagine after a really good workout, you're craving some protein. So where do you go to get it? Change up. Don't make a shake. Don't eat a bar. Grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper instead. Hear me out. Why Old Trapper? Because Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty, it's tender. It's made with real strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire. And it's a family-owned business. They take their smoked beef extremely seriously. You can taste it in every single bite. I mean, who wants dried, tough beef in a bag? Nobody. It's like eating an old shoe. Old Trapper, though, is the real deal. Comes in four amazing flavors. Old Fashioned, Teriyaki, Peppered, and Hot and Spicy. So the next time you want a great protein and energy snack that you can have anytime, anywhere, grab some Old Trapper Beef Jerky. Look for it in the Clearview bag. That way you can see exactly what you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. If you don't see it, ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? He's Jordan Burroughs. Jordan, it's great to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing well, Jim. Thanks for the invitation, man. I appreciate it. It's good,
Jordan,
to be here.
Great to talk to you. Great to have you on the program. Listen, there's so much I want to talk to you about, Jordan, but before we go anywhere else, I want to ask you about the Buffalo Bills because this is a big Buffalo Bills house. I know you're a big Bills fan. How did you first get into the Buffalo Bills?
Yeah, wild, man. So I grew up in South Jersey, right outside of Philly. And so my parents were always longtime Eagles fan, but you know, just a little resistant to the in-house sports team product. So I was a Denver Broncos fan as a kid. All those, you know, great teams in 97 and 98. But when I was courting my current wife, I realized that I wanted to be involved with a program that wasn't just based on geography. My wife's from Buffalo, New York. Her uncle actually is Thurman Thomas. And so I got to meet, well, we call him Uncle Thurm. Spent a lot of time with Thurman Thomas. He brought me into the fold, introduced me to the coaching staff. I've talked to the Bills organization numerous times. I text back and forth with Coach McDermott. And so it is a special relationship that I have with the Bills, and it's really a hometown team. And so whenever we're back in Buffalo, we always try to connect with the Bills, and we have some friends that work in an organization as well. And, yeah, man, it's been a great team to root for. They represent most of what American society looks like. They're gritty, they're tough, they're working class, and I think they are America's team. I know the Cowboys are considered America's team, but they represent the working class of America, and that's why I'm happy to be a Bills fan.
My man, I agree with everything you just said, except for that last part about America's team, because I glossed to Cleveland. And don't get this twisted. I mean, I love the Bills. I love that town. I love that organization. I love that team, except I've been calling the Cleveland Browns America's team for the last part of 2 years now, but pretty much for the same reasons you just mentioned. I mean, that's amazing. Jordan Burrow's my guest, the way he laid that whole thing out. Sunday also, you tweeted, quote, "It seems as if most NFL players with wrestling backgrounds are linemen. What other football positions do former wrestlers gravitate towards?" And I'd like to know just how many NFL players also wrestled in high school. Like, so when you're watching football, especially offensive and defensive linemen, what are you seeing that looks familiar to you?
For sure. So I think that what translates well for linemen specifically is the hand fight. So knowing how to stand up an opponent, knowing how to move an opponent, in order to either, you know, get through them, get them underneath of you, keep them off of your quarterback, or get to their quarterback. I think that's a really big part of wrestling. Is it's almost like boxing. You have to know how to move your body, control positional awareness, using your hands to really control the body of your opponent. But also, I think that what I've seen a lot lately, and you think that would translate better, would be the tackling ability. Every time I see a double leg in football or a standard tackle, I'm like, man, this looks so much like wrestling. And so I think that what I could help to do, or if more football players were interested in the sport and really kind of use that as cross training, is just the standard double leg in wrestling looks almost identical to a tackle with good form. Hands behind your running back or wide receiver's thighs, making sure that your head's up and in, making sure that, you know, you have a strong head and strong neck, and then running the guy down and driving him to the ground. So I think wrestling translates well because we're tough. We work hard. We're able to just be in intimate settings where we're so close to our opponent, and it just it makes for good action. And so it's fun to see all the wrestlers go on to be good football players. Listen, I was really – my senior year of high school, I weighed 135 pounds. So although I had – supreme tackling skills, I never had the size to be in the NFL. So I think that's why linemen transition most, is because they have the skill set, but they also have the size and the frame to do well. So, you know, I think if you ask the average high school wrestler, would they rather play in the NFL or would they, you know, rather wrestle? I think most of them would say play in the NFL, but I think that, you know, wrestling, because of weight classes, the smallest weight class being 103 pounds and the largest being heavyweight, there's not many of us who can actually transition to the NFL. So it's cool to see the linemen actually do it.
Jordan Burrow is joining us. Now, anytime an Olympic wrestler comes on the program, I hear from a ton of fans of the sport. Like, as you go back, when you were 5 years old, you just got started in that sport. How did you first get into wrestling?
Yeah, so I was a big fan of WWE. Or WWF at that time, right? So I used to watch a lot of guys, Macho Man, Randy Savage, Hulk Hogan, The Ultimate Warrior, Edge and Christian, The Brood, like all these guys, those were my guys. And so with my cousin Tyler, we spent a lot of time strolling the aisles of Walmart and Target looking for action figures from the WWF. We had a ring, we had all the video games, we watched SmackDown and Raw and SummerSlam and WrestleMania, all these things that like we were wrestling gurus. And so when I finally got an opportunity to do it, I was like, man, is this going to be like what I see on TV? Am I going to be able to jump off the top ropes and do a frog splash and slam through people through tables? So I thought that was really cool. But when I got to the local gymnasium at my town's high school and saw that there were just wrestling mats laid out, and you had to wear a singlet and headgear, it was much different than what I expected. But I was the youngest of four in the run of my family, so wrestling was one of the few sports you didn't have to be big in stature to be successful because of the weight classes. And I was scrappy young man, and I was competitive right away. And I won my very first tournament. I didn't even win the tournament, but I got a participation trophy. And that's what kind of hooked me, is I got the chance to like have a tangible piece of evidence from a competition, and I was hooked. My dad would take me to the trophy room before every tournament. He'd show me all the trophies, say, "Son, you see that big trophy over there, the tallest one in the room? That's for the guy that wins first place. That's if you win all your matches today." So that was kind of what motivated me as a kid. And, you know, 25 years later, I'm still at it. Trophies have gotten a little smaller, but the stakes have gotten higher, and it's still a fun time for me.
Jordan Burroughs is joining us. So then you go to Nebraska, and you had a challenging freshman year, but then over the next 3 years, you went 1-11-6, and then you go on an absolute tear. You're ripping off NCAA championships, the U.S. Open, then the World Championships in 2011, and then in 2012, you go to London for the Olympics. What do you remember about the experience of winning a gold medal?
There's nothing like it, Jim. There's really nothing like it. Wrestling, the pinnacle of our sport is the Olympic gold. We don't have a championship season, you know, much like you see in the NFL with the playoffs. So it was something that I had dreamed about for a long time, but to actually have it and feel it was something completely different. I had never even seen or touched an Olympic gold medal until it was actually placed around my neck. And so that was the first one I had ever seen, standing on top of the podium, watching the American flag being raised high with my hand over top of my heart. And just standing there, I'm like, man, I did this. I remember watching the Olympics in Atlanta and Sydney and Athens, and, you know, thinking like, man, how cool would that be to be there? And then to actually be there, and not only be there and participate, but to win it, it's indescribable. It was a lot of fun.
Jordan Burroughs joining us. So then, Jordan, you keep on dominating, and then you go to Rio, and things don't work out as well as you would have hoped. You lose in the quarterfinals, and then you said some really interesting things about the experience. Like, you go to Rio to win, and that's the only outcome on your mind, and then it doesn't happen. And then you made the point you had to go about rebuilding yourself mentally and psychologically. How did you do that, and what was that process like? What were the types of things you were dealing with emotionally?
Yeah, it was a dark time. I think one of the hardest things about being a professional athlete is your failures are public. The average person, if something happens to them, no one really knows about it. But for us, people are watching it. People are in the stands with their camera phones, and you're publicly crucified. And so it's a very difficult time. You have to rebuild your identity separate from your occupation. Everyone calls you the champ, or everyone knows who you are and what you do, and you're heralded as this hero. But when you get beat, you know, you have like this scarlet letter and the stigma where everyone's like, man, I'm so sorry that things didn't work out for you. So to rebuild, I had to really just reevaluate my goals. I had to rebuild my confidence, be, you know, confident in my abilities, knowing what I could do moving forward. But I had to cling closely to my team and have a lot of faith moving forward, because I knew that it was going to be hard going in front of my contemporaries and all my peers once again. And, you know, knowing that I didn't perform to the best of my ability, it was tough. It was humiliating and embarrassing. But I got a great team of people. I got a great wife. Everyone encouraged me and pumped me up, told me I was still great. I could still do it. I still had opportunities ahead of me, and that the best years of my competition were still in front of me. And so just dug down deep and just got back to it and just ignored the critics and stopped reading the forums and stopped listening to what analysts had to say about my performance and just started believing in myself. And things worked out for me.
I love it. Jordan Burroughs joining us. Of course, Jordan, the question always comes up with wrestlers, and that's whether or not they can make the transition to MMA. There are so many guys who've done it and done it really well, actually. How much consideration have you even given to making a move to MMA? Is it a possibility?
A ton, bro. A ton. Listen, I follow Conor McGregor on Instagram. I see him pull up with a new Rolex and a Bentley, you know, driving a Lamborghini to practice, and, you know, riding a yacht into Abu Dhabi to Fight Island. I'm like, damn, I should have fought. And so it's an interesting dynamic, because, you know, I think I could really translate well. Most of the champions in MMA are former wrestlers. Kamaru Usman, Henry Cejudo, John Jones, Daniel Cormier, all these guys were great wrestlers, and I was teammates and trained alongside them guys. So I was like, if they could do it, I could do it. But It's a different sport. It's a completely different sport, and I have so much appreciation and admiration for those guys. But I love wrestling. Wrestling's my craft, and it's what I've honed on into. It's not as sexy, not as glamorous. You don't make as much money, but I think what we do is all about honor, and that's what makes it cool for me. So, you know, I'm a big fan of MMA, but at the end of the day, I love wrestling, number one. And number two, I just don't want to get punched in the face, bro. Like, it's such a different sport. In wrestling, if you lose, you got taken down. You might got put into your back and pinned. But if you get beat in a fight, you got choked out, tapped out, someone's broken something. Wrestling match, you lose, you go to have dinner with your family. If you lose an MMA fight, you go to the hospital. So it's just something that I'm not really interested in doing, but I will be an advocate for it because I love watching it.
Jordan, that is such a great response. You know, when you said that there's a nobility in wrestling and then there's honor in that, I mean, absolutely, 100%. And I don't think those things are necessarily mutually exclusive. I'm sure you'd agree. Like, Daniel Cormier is one of the classiest guys ever awesome. In any walk of life. What do you think? Like, to your point about, yeah, it's not an easy way to make a living, getting punched in the face and kneed in the face. What's it say about the breed? What's it say about the breed of athlete that it takes to step into the octagon? Can you even explain what that's like for the fans who are so into it but have no idea the price that's being paid?
Yeah, for sure. I think it takes a certain level of fearlessness, and I don't necessarily say fearlessness. It's bravery. No one is absent of fear. Everyone's scared, everyone's nervous, everyone's anxious when that gate closes behind you and you step into that octagon with the person across from you wanting to kill you. But I think that there's a certain level of courage and bravery that it takes to get in there because you know what you're made of and you know what you're willing to display to the world. And so when you step into that ring, you want to put on a show for the fans and you want to display all of the skills that you've been, you know, honing and spending hours sacrificing to, you know, to craft. And I think that's what's really special about the MMA world is these guys are real athletes. This is no longer the early stages of the UFC where these guys are just random brawlers that they pick out of a bar to go in there and fight bare knuckle. These guys are high-level professional athletes that are training with the professionals in every single field. And so, you know, I think I liken it to, like, heptathletes and decathletes and track and field, where these people are masters of every single craft, from wrestling to jiu-jitsu to judo, you know, to kickboxing. They do such a tremendous job. And, you know, I think that it's a new breed of athlete. People are going to start to grow up and train specifically to be fighters, not to be, you know, wrestlers or boxers or go to the NFL or NBA. They are going to train specifically to go to the UFC. And so it's a new generation of fighters that are going to be coming up soon, but it takes a lot of bravery to do what they do, and that's why I'm a huge fan of it. They're good men in that sport, good women in that sport, and great athletes.
Extremely well said. And this is why, to my point, everybody loses, like, well, except for maybe Habib, but everybody loses because of the multitude of disciplines. There are so many different ways to get caught. Really quickly, Jordan, what's the rest of your schedule look like for 2021? How does the year shape up for you?
Yeah, so I have seen that there was a statement from the Japanese Prime Minister just recently that he still wants to hold the Olympic Games. So the Olympics from 2020, Tokyo, Japan, were postponed to the summer of 2021. And so right now, that's what we're continuously preparing for. Our Olympic trials, which is our qualification process for the Olympic Games, happens in April. I'll be wrestling there. If I win there, best 2 out of 3 against my opponent, I'll be on the U.S. Olympic team at 74 kilograms or 163 pounds. And I'll get to compete in August of 2021 for my chance to win a second Olympic gold medal. So super exciting times for myself and my family and my teammates. And we are just training, getting my weight down, getting ready for the Olympic trials, and hopefully going out there and putting on the show.
My guy, what a great conversation. He's already got the gold medal. He's a 4-time world champion, second American wrestler in history to win 3 world or Olympic gold medals in a row, Jordan Burroughs. Jordan, so great to have you on the show. You nailed that. Great to talk to you, and I hope we can do it again soon.
Yes, sir. Jim, thank you.
So Andy Reid meets with the media yesterday, and as you might imagine, Big Red was in all his glory, full form. At one point, he was asked about that fourth down call. Question: when did fourth and one become a throwing down? Andy Reid, and I quote, "I went to BYU. Every down is a throwing down." End of quote. Hell yes. Love that response. Shout out to the Cougs. Shout out to Lavelle Edwards. Shout out to the OG of the modern passing game. Shout out to the godfather of the air raid. That answer says so much about Andy Reid. Fourth and one is a throwing down when you have complete and total confidence in your passing game. Complete and total confidence in your receivers. Man, that confidence is so great that he was willing to make a fourth and one a passing down, knowing that Chad Henne was going to be the guy passing the ball. Most coaches who have Henne in that game, in that situation, are saying the fourth and one is a punting down. And so is third down. Hell, probably second down too. Man, just get that guy off the field and see if our defense can make something happen. But not Andy. Andy's got so much confidence in all of his guys. And if you want to see trust and you want to see confidence in his guys, I suggest you check out his answer as to the question of why Eric Bieniemy has not been hired as a head coach yet. Because that really is one of the biggest mysteries in the sport right now. How was the guy who was regarded as the best candidate last year and was passed over on the verge of getting passed over again?
We're in another hiring cycle, and he just hasn't gotten that opportunity yet to be a head coach.
I mean, everybody knows what I think of Eric and what kind of head coach I think he'd be. And maybe the best thing I can tell you is I hope he goes to the NFC when he has that opportunity. But whoever gets him, I think, is a very lucky organization. Somebody that I've come across, one of the few people I've come across that has the leadership skills that he has, the ability to lead men in this crazy game that we're in. And for those guys, through his leadership, to play at a Pro Bowl level. And so when he gets his hands on you, figuratively, he does wonders with athletes. And he's able to maximize their abilities on the field, and he gives them that extra boost to be a productive person off the field, and somebody that I would love my son to have played for.
I think the entire answer is great, but especially the end, quote, when he gets his hands on you figuratively, he does wonders with athletes, and he's able to maximize their abilities on the field, and he gives them that extra boost to be a productive person off the field, and somebody I would have loved for my son to have played for. Praise does not get any higher than that. Endorsements do not get any stronger than that. He's not just saying that Bieniemy is a good coach. He's saying he's the kind of guy that he would have wanted his son to play for. That's all you need to know. So some folks have been working really hard to try to find a reason why Bieniemy has not been given a head coaching gig. Because unless there's something that the rest of us don't know about, it doesn't make any sense at all. So now folks are grasping at straws. It seems like some have settled on this notion that he's just in the right place at the right time, that he's really not that great. He's just lucky to have Andy Reid as the head coach and Patrick Mahomes as the quarterback. Anybody would look good in that situation. Except that Reid is telling you that's not the case. Mahomes himself is saying that that's not the case. Mahomes said this about Bieniemy, quote, "His track record speaks for itself. The type of man he is, the way he can control and be a leader of the locker room, the way that he coaches and schemes he brings to us. If he doesn't, people are crazy." End quote. So if your justification or rationalization was that he's with Reed and Mahomes and that's why he's good, then that argument goes right out the window because Reed and Mahomes are telling you that he is special, that he is different. If you need more, there's more. Jamal Charles told CBSSports.com, quote, "Every guy Eric Bieniemy touches, he raises their game, whoever they are. Pat Mahomes would be Pat, but I don't think he'd be as good as he is without Coach Bieniemy teaching him the details about blitz packages. He's very smart, very intelligent. He gets in his players' heads, and he brings out the best in them," end quote. And then there are those claims that, yeah, but the guy doesn't interview well. Has to be that, right? He doesn't interview well. He didn't interview well, for instance, with the Atlanta Falcons. Well, D. Orlando Ledbetter of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution has already punted that idea out of the stadium. Quote, "Don't waste your time with the Eric Bieniemy didn't crush his interview with the Falcons reports. It's not accurate. Now enjoy Super Wildcard Weekend," end quote. And the craziest thing about all of this is, while a guy like Bieniemy is getting passed over, the Detroit Lions appear to be on the verge of hiring Saints tight ends coach D. Dan Campbell. And if your reaction to that is, who? You're not alone. No disrespect to Dan Campbell. But seriously, how is he getting a head coaching gig before the guy with a Super Bowl ring who is running the most exciting offense in football and has developed the most dynamic quarterback in the game? Oh, and speaking of success, that's the other thing that is being held against Bieniemy. For some reason, it seems like some teams have tried to justify not hiring him by saying, well, it's because he's still in the tournament. He's still coaching in the playoffs. We can't spend the time we need. Yeah, right. He's still coaching right now. You know why? Because he's damn good. Isn't the fact that he's got a great look at another ring a great thing? And while we're at it, how is it that there are 32 head coaching jobs and only two are currently held by black men? I mean, really, how is that possible? I already know the answer. I just hate that that's the case. Listen, you can rain out baseball. You can rain out tennis. You can rain out golf, but you cannot rain out life. Sometimes, no matter how hard it's coming down out there, you've just got to get in your car, brave the elements, and get to the people who need you most. That's why you need windshield wipers that you can trust. You need wipers from Bosch. Rated by Fortune as 2020's number one auto parts supplier, Bosch makes high-performance windshield wipers that handle the harshest weather conditions so you can reach life's important moments. See what matters most with Bosch. Richard Pitino is my guest. Richard, it's been a while since you and I spoke, so bring me up to date. How are you doing? How is life for you right now?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you having me. When I heard your intro about you being in sunny Southern California, and I'm in snowy Minnesota right now, so I'm a little bit jealous. But I'm good. Doesn't matter what the weather is. When you win your last game, you're happy, and we were fortunate to do that.
I get that. Richard Pitino is my guest. Speaking of which, you're coming off that win over number 7, Michigan, 75-57. That was on Saturday. The Wolverines were undefeated coming in. They had beaten you a week and a half earlier. So what was your message to your team going into the rematch?
Well, I mean, obviously, they did an unbelievable job with us at their place. I mean, they just kicked our butt, and they've done that to a lot of teams, and they were playing really well. So I think the familiarity of playing them, I think it was 10 days before, it was fresh on our guys' minds. So they have pride and made a couple little minor adjustments. But I think more than anything was we just showed a level of toughness that we did not show in Ann Arbor. And, you know, it was we're fortunate because Michigan is a terrific team with a lot of talent and they're very well coached.
We were talking to Richard Pitino. You know, part of the message seems to me before the game was to your big man, Liam Robbins, and you want to remind him, look, you're a junior. Michigan's big man, Hunter Dickinson, is a freshman. He's really good, but you wanted Robbins to act like the junior that he is. He goes out, he has 22 and 8 rebounds. How pleased were you with the way he acted on that message?
Well, it's exactly what we said. I mean, it's we have respect for Hunter Dickinson. I think he's going to be a good player for a long time, but you cannot allow a freshman to push you around like he did. And it wasn't just Liam. It was everybody. But Liam had a great response. I mean, he was blocking shots. He was hitting threes. He was demanding the ball in the post. You know, our league has got some of the best big men in the country. And when you have a guy like Liam Robbins who transfers up from Drake, you know, Drake's a good conference, but they don't have the bigs that the Big Ten does in that at that level. So I think Liam's kind of learning on the fly a little bit, but his response certainly after, you know, Dickinson having 28 points was terrific. Limited him to, I think, 5 attempts from the field. We turned him over a bunch, so it was a terrific effort all around and a great step for Liam in his growth.
We are talking to Richard Pitino. You know, Robbins, as you point out, is one of a number of transfers on the roster, including Marcus Carr, who's averaging 21 points and 6 assists. What does he mean to you and to the program, Carr?
Well, Carr is, you know, the transfers is kind of the new wave, and I don't even really love it, but it's just part of the way it's evolving. And Carr certainly feels like he's grown throughout the process in our program because unlike some transfers, Carr had to sit out, you know. So he's been in our program. This is year 3 for him, and I just think he's one of the best point guards in the country. He broke the single-season record for assists in school history as a sophomore. He's obviously had some 30-plus point games. He's so confident. He's got a great belief in what he's doing. And he's just kind of like our veteran leader who just has a very, very confident, calming presence on the court. And if you have good guards, it gives you a chance, especially at this, in this league.
Minnesota head coach Richard Pitino joining us once again. You know, your point about transfers is interesting. I've talked to pretty much every coach, or I've asked every college coach who's come on about that very thing. So how do you go about evaluating players as to whether or not they'd be a good fit as a transfer? For instance, is it like evaluating a player out of high school, or is it a little bit different?
It's totally different. And, you know, the hard part is you don't know about the waiver process. And I do think that college sports is moving to it where you're going to have a one-time transfer where you don't have to sit out. But you're going to look at a player differently if he can play right away versus sit out. I mean, there could be some guys that need to put on some weight and grow and develop in your program, and there are guys who can make an immediate impact. So you have to evaluate every situation and say, okay, because you can't take a transfer that you don't need, because it's their second time around. The hourglass is running out for them a little bit, so the situation has to be right. And, I mean, I have four kids in my starting lineup who are transfers, and all four of them understood what we had to offer, and they said, okay, this makes sense. So it's a little bit more complex when you're taking, quote, mid-majors because you don't know how their skill is going to translate. But there's nothing like seeing college film and being able to compare them to other college athletes versus maybe a bad AAU game or a bad high school game.
Right, but then to your point also, then if they transfer up, they enter into this gauntlet and this level of competition that they may not be accustomed to. As an example, I had Ohio State's Chris Holtman on the program yesterday. We were talking about how rough the Big Ten is, and especially this year. He said he thinks that one of the keys to success in the conference is you can't have any memory whatsoever. I mean, literally, you play the game, and then regardless of the result, you move on to the next game because you don't want one loss to turn into a bunch. Is that how it feels to you as well? How do you approach it?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I remember one year we were a five seed in the NCAA tournament 3-4 years ago, and we started off the conference, I think 1-3 or 1-4, and no big meeting, no big changes. We ended up not losing for a whole month of February. You just have to stay the course, because every game, it almost feels like a football where it's like a new week every week. And even if you win, like, we played, I think it was 8 ranked opponents in a row, the toughest stretch in the history of Gopher basketball, and now we don't have any ranked opponents on our schedule moving forward. That doesn't mean we're going to win them all. That doesn't mean that those opponents aren't tough. Like, Maryland's a team that's trying to go to a Final Four. You know, Purdue's trying to go to a Final Four. So you have so many programs in the Big Ten. I mean, really, Nebraska's rebuilding a little bit with Fred Hoiberg. You have 13 out of the 14 that are expecting to go to the NCAA tournament. Not all conferences are like that, so it's incredibly competitive.
Richard Pitino joining me for a few more moments. You mentioned Nebraska. You were supposed to play them tomorrow night, but that game had to be postponed because a total of 12 people in the program have been in isolation or quarantine. I mean, what's it been like to coach through a season when you know the schedule can change at any given moment?
Yeah, it's really been challenging, but, you know, I think we all would agree. I mean, it's better than not playing the games. I mean, I think what the fans and the media don't see is, you know, you're getting tested. You have false positives, you know, like all the time. So all of a sudden you may have a practice in 2 hours and a guy gets a positive, and you got to isolate him, and you got to do another test, and you got to wait for the results back, and he's late for practice, or you're moving there, you're doing that. So you just have to accept the fact that it's not even a little bit normal. We have to try very hard to do things safely and to make sure that the people – I mean, I had a player who was playing about 8 minutes a game for me opted out because he didn't feel safe, and that's okay. Like, you don't have to play. You don't have to coach in this environment, but I truly believe every game that we're able to play, we've played 15. Every game is a gift. We're lucky to have it. We're lucky to have – you know, kind of nurses every day trying to help us through this, and an administration is trying to help us. But you have to be ready to adapt, and you have to be ready to get those phone calls that say, okay, Nebraska's postponed. You got to move on to the next one. And as I always say, I mean, it's better than the alternative, which is not playing.
Richard Pitino is joining us. Let me ask you this. I know you're focused on this season, and this season more than any other is day-to-day for sure. But if you were to go back for a moment, I thought last year was so interesting and so different for your team in the sense that you were 30th in the nation in offensive efficiency. You were 41st in defense, but 351st out of 353 in Ken Pom's luck factor rankings. I mean, as a coach, how do you go about dealing with luck in that way? Is it something you can coach, or is it just a matter of the ball bouncing one way or the other?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, like, I was looking at the Ken Pom stuff this morning, and I think we're in the 20s in luck. So, I mean, you hope it evens out somewhat. I wish it wasn't quite as volatile, the number. But that's what I was telling people last year. It's, you know, I've been cut short. We were 15. We thought if we got two more wins, we would have gotten into the NCAA tournament because our strength of schedule was so hard and our advanced analytics were good. So, you know, you just try to stay the course. And if you give yourself a chance, whether it's your offensive efficiency or your defensive efficiency where you're top 30 in both, you're going to be in games. Now it comes down to making free throws, taking care of the ball, executing all those things. But I certainly haven't changed my coaching this year versus last year. And for whatever reason, we're a lot luckier than we were last year. So you just kind of hope it all evens out and you give yourself a chance by being really good at those numbers.
And then finally, in terms of changing your coaching, I mentioned off the very top that it is your eighth season with Minnesota. Hard to imagine. I mean, it feels like yesterday that you were hired. How different are you now as a head coach than when you first arrived?
Oh, you hate to say it, but I'm just so much better now than I was 8 years ago. And it's not necessarily the coaching of one game. You know, I mean, I think that when I was, 30 years old as a head coach, I was going to prepare the team versus a Michigan State or an Ohio State just as well as I did now. It's just an understanding of the big picture, how to run a program, how to deal with all the different variables. But kind of like you said about Chris Holtman, I mean, the best I've gotten of any of it is I've gotten to a point where we win a game. I mean, I'm excited, and I'm going to enjoy it that night, but I move on. If we lose a game, I'm going to be mad, but I move on. You have to be able to have the experience to know what this league is all about and coaching at this level is. And when you're young, you don't know what you don't know. And I've definitely grown into it. I'm definitely better from it and just continue to try to work harder to continue to improve every day.
40% of all food produced every single year literally goes wasted and uneaten. That's the number I've seen. Fair to say now that the Cleveland Cavaliers and their recently rearranged locker room have officially contributed to that staggering number, because apparently one of their first round picks from 2019 melted down over the weekend and started throwing food all over that joint. I'm talking about Kevin Porter Jr. You might remember that name. 20-year-old. Former high school standout, drafted out of USC, soon to be kicked out of Cleveland altogether. Now, Porter has not been with the Cavs all season. He's been away dealing with, quote, personal issues. You know, so you hope that guy takes the time and he gets right. You hope he takes the time and he gets help. The absence comes on the heels of barrel rolling his SUV down the highway back in November. Cops also found a handgun and some weed in the glove box of that flipped over, banged up sled. So my man needs help. So when you consider that he dropped in the draft just a year before because of a misconduct suspension at USC, you can see how he does need help and how this thing is starting to get away from him. And he's just one season into the NBA, and he's only 20. He's still just 20. Now, despite those red flags, coming out of college, the Cavaliers did trade up, and they grabbed him with that final pick in the first round. And then he rewarded or repaid them by going for a respectable 10 points, 3 boards, and a couple of dimes off the bench in his rookie season. That's why they moved up to get him. He had that kind of promise. He has that kind of promise. But then he wrecked his rig. He admitted to underage drinking. He was found with a firearm and some Kron in his car. And despite all the charges against him being dropped, he never did come back to the team for this season. And again, a number of players are opting out for whatever reason. The pandemic, mental health, whatever the reason might be. But then he did return finally this past Friday. Now, according to reports, the Cavaliers were happy to see him because they felt like it signified that he was one step closer to rejoining the team completely as a player. So him showing up was a good thing, until it wasn't. Because apparently, when he got to the locker room, he realized the team moved his locker. And that's when Porter decided to start moving food through the air. The Athletic reported yesterday that Porter, quote, grew angry when he entered the locker room and realized that the team gave his old locker to Taurean Prince, who was acquired in a blockbuster trade Wednesday. Sources said Porter, whose locker was moved to the wall where the younger end-of-the-bench players reside, began yelling and at one point threw food. End quote. So upon realizing that he was no longer on the front row, Millionaire's Row, whatever you want to call it, then he got moved to the back row, he then decided to weaponize food. I only wish that we knew what exactly it was that he was lobbing around the locker room in a fit of rage. Are we talking about a sando? Are we talking about a donut? Or are we talking about donuts, more hot soup? Like, for Porter to be upset that the team stuck him with the younger end-of-the-bench players to the point that he's weaponizing food, man, that is rich. Really rich. For one, he is one of the younger players. He's 20. It's his second year. And on top of that, he's not even an end-of-the-bench player right now because he hasn't even been on the bench itself. End-of-the-bench would be an upgrade from not with the team this year. So my man should consider himself lucky that given what he's gone through and what he's dealing with and some of the choices that he's made, that he still has a locker, regardless of where it is in the room. The Athletic also reported that GM Coby Altman and head coach J.B. Bickerstaff confronted Porter during the meltdown, but that Porter was, quote, combative with Altman, end of quote. And that Bickerstaff was, quote, shocked and disgusted, end of quote, with what Porter was saying. I'll tell you what, man. An NBA head coach is probably, even a young guy like that, has probably seen and heard everything. Everything. You know what it would take then for an NBA coach to be, quote, shocked and disgusted over something a player said? I would love to know what he said. According to sources, Altman told Porter to clean out his locker and go home. And then Altman told the team Porter would not be coming back. You gotta love the idea of the GM telling the player to clean out his locker. A locker that the team had just moved. The locker that apparently caused the whole freak out in the first place. Oh, you're pissed that we moved your locker over there to the rest of the guys who are young and at the end of the bench? You want me to go clean out that locker? The whole thing that precipitated this whole thing? Apparently, the Cavs spent all weekend trying to trade him, but there weren't any takers. Yeah, I'm sure that didn't exactly hype up his trade value. I don't know, maybe it's having a gun and Kron in a rig that he rolled. Maybe it's confronting and being combative with the GM who traded up to get him. Maybe it's all the food that's currently still sticking to the walls of the Cavalier facility right now. Here's to the Cavs having a sign in their locker room that counts the days since their last food-throwing incident, like a counter. Here's to J.R. Swish texting a thumbs-up emoji to Kevin Porter Jr. after reading that story. I mean, like, letting your hands go is one thing. Letting your food go is another. And yes, I do understand that nobody likes their personal stuff moved around. I mean, I understand where that'd be off-putting. If I came in this studio and somebody moved my lapper out of here and my earbuds out of here and rearranged all my stuff and didn't tell me, I'd probably get pretty heated too. You could see why Porter didn't take this well. It's like if you go back to work after an extended leave and they move your office down the hall to the other side of the building when you already had that great spot right near the break room or right near the elevator and nobody tells you, you're going to be hot. Memo to all NBA teams, to avoid future food fights, Just have HR knock out a quick email to the guy that his locker is being reassigned, and that way you can avoid the hassle of having to scrub Salisbury steak or chicken cacciatore off of the locker room walls. All it would take is a quick email and clones. Harden was a part of the trade that sent Taurean to the Cavs, but he was not in Brooklyn, or he was, so he was not there to eat or lick all the food off the wall that Porter was throwing around. We are joined by Billy Turner. Billy, it's great to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing well, man. How are you?
Man, I'm great. I'm awesome. It's good to hear your voice. Listen, before I talk to you about this weekend, if I can get you to look back once on Saturday's game, let me start right there. You and the rest of the offensive linemen knew that you were going up against Aaron Donald and the rest of that excellent defensive front the Rams have. So what was the mindset and the approach of the offensive line, your offensive line, going into that game?
The mentality was no different than it has been all season in any of the games that we had played. We knew that, you know, we were playing the number one, supposedly the number one defense in the NFL statistically. We knew that we were going up against a guy like Aaron Donald, you know, arguably one of, if not the best defensive player in NFL history. And honestly, the mentality, the approach, and the preparation was no different.
Billy Turner joining us. So then the line goes out and you pave the way for nearly 200 rushing yards. You do not allow a single sack. How much pride then is there for you to have such a dominant performance on the big stage in a big game like that?
There's pride, yeah, but to be honest with you, that's the standard for the Green Bay Packers. It's the standard for our offense, and that's the standard in our offensive line room. So I wouldn't say that, you know, there was anything done that you know, we personally felt like we exceeded the norm in regards to that game. We did what we were supposed to do, and we came out with a victory, and that's what we wanted to do. We, you know, we always want to go out and we want to be dominant in nature in the run game and in the pass game. But, you know, as far as pressure sacks, quarterback hits, and rushing yards, you know what, our standard is set very high, and you know, there's definitely another gear and another level that we can all reach.
All right, so the standard is the standard. Billy Turner is joining us. And Bill, you were playing left tackle against the Rams. That's where you played in college. But in the NFL, you've moved around. Left tackle, left guard, right tackle. What's it like to move between positions like that at that level? How challenging is that?
I mean, it's not the greatest thing in the world. It's not fun, but right. To be completely honest with you, it's something that I've done throughout my entire career at multiple levels, and, you know, I've just kind of become accustomed to it. It's something that allows you to focus in a little bit more on your technique and your fundamentals and offensive line play, and you know what, every position is different, and every side of the line is different, and, you know, it's a big, big mental game when you have to switch sides, especially when you know you're at one position at one point in the game and then you're at another position at another point in the game. And whether it's week to week, month to month, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't get any easier, but you know, it's no different than any type of adversity that people have to face in everyday life.
So I'm looking for an analogy, and I think I found one. Josh Sitton used to come on this show quite a bit back in the day. One of my favorite guys. You recently referenced him in talking about the difference between playing right tackle and left tackle, because according to Josh, quote, it's like wiping your ass with your opposite hand. Is that how it seems to
that
you?
Is correct.
Is that an apt description?
Yeah, man. It's awkward. You know, it's not, like I said, it's not anything you ever really get used to. And it's, I mean, try writing a sentence with your right hand or your dominant hand and then switching over to your left and writing it with your left hand is probably going to look ugly unless you're ambidextrous, you know. So it's nothing that's easy. Playing offensive line in the NFL, it's not really – one of those things where you go back and forth. You know what I mean? There's certain guys in this league. For instance, David Bakhtiari is the best left tackle, in my opinion, in football. David is a left tackle. Billy Turner is an offensive lineman. I don't necessarily really have a home on the offensive line because I've been all over at all those different positions. And that is how I master my game, and that is how I make my living in this league.
Billy Turner is joining us. You mentioned Bakhtiari, and I could tell in the way you mentioned him, the kind of respect you have for him. Listen, I understand that you're in a very different business. I understand as part of the business, guys go down, and the next guy has to be ready, and you got to move on quickly. You have to have a short memory. But when you know a guy like that, and you know how much he cares, how hard he works, the kind of pride he has, and that he's missing out on this, what kind of thoughts do you have about that?
Man, it's tough. It's tough to see a guy like that, like you just kind of mentioned, somebody who cares so much and puts so much dedication and time into the game. It's tough to see anybody at that get injured, you know, but when it's one of the leaders of the team, it's just a little bit tougher. It hits a little bit different, you know, in that regard. But to be honest with you, Dave has handled this extremely well, in my opinion. Going into work, seeing him in the training room, seeing him attack his rehab no differently than he attacks a game plan every single week when he's going out there getting ready to play a game at left tackle. You know, he's asking each and every one of us if we need any type of help, if we need him to do any film study or to do any type of, you know, looking back on games that we've already played or any type of opinion. You know what I mean? He's offering himself up, you know, to our expense, even though he is injured, you know. So it's very easy to say, you know, oh, the Green Bay Packers are playing in the NFC Championship game without, you know, left tackle Dave Bakhtiari, but that's not the truth. The fact of the matter is that we have just as much, if not more, communication with Dave in regards to these games and these game plans the last 2 weeks that we have had all year.
Billy Turner joining me. You know, Billy, talking to you, I'm struck by this opinion I have. Some conversations with linemen, and I have a technical position. So the guys who play it generally are really smart, really sharp. They've got great personalities, but generally speaking, you guys do not get the media attention that you probably deserve. Why do you think that is?
Man, we're in our own little bubble. We're all built completely different. Not one of us is alike. We don't need media attention, and we don't crave media attention. The way that we're built is to go out there and to get the job done, and the most thing that is important to us as offensive linemen is to help teams win football games. You know, it's not to be in the limelight and to have everybody know who you are. Personally, me, I could care less if anybody knows who the hell I am. It really doesn't faze me. What I am here to do is to help the Green Bay Packers win football games and win championships. That is my job. That is what I signed up for, and that is what I told these coaches when I came here and signed that contract. So anything else after that is, you know, just extra bullshit, to be honest with you, that most offensive linemen just don't really care about.
My man, Billy Turner is joining us. Respect. I respect the answer. You've got the Bucs coming to your place Sunday. You faced them once already this year. It didn't go the way you would have liked, of course. What are your early thoughts on the matchup this time?
You know what? We did not play our best football in that first matchup. That is quite obvious going back, watching the film, and playing in that game. It was very obvious. So, you know what? That game was a couple months ago, and that's a part of our identity as a football team, 100%, yes. But with that being said, going through that game and getting through that adversity throughout the course of this season has only made us stronger and only made us a better football team. So I expect us to come out and play an entirely different football game on Sunday. And I expect us to go out there to have fun and cut it loose like we've been doing lately.
Hey, Billy, speaking of identity, as some people know, you are really big into fashion. How did you first get into it, and what is your approach when it comes to fashion?
Man, how did I get into it? I have no idea. You know, my family members, my mom, my dad, my brothers, my aunts, uncles, grandparents, everyone kind of has their own type of style, you know. And growing up, knowing everyone in my family and seeing all these different styles, it's just, it was something that was very visually appealing to me, but it was also something that I tapped into. And that's kind of how I figured out that throughout life and in society that everyone is completely different. And people can like certain things and be best friends, and you know, your best friend can like and dress completely differently than you. And that's, you know, kind of the case with me and a lot of my homies and a lot of the people that I hold close to my heart. So kind of moving forward, I found a likeness for art and creation, and I just kind of started doing things on my own. You know, art was one of my favorite classes when I was in elementary school, middle school, high school, all the way on up. And I just kind of started creating stuff. And honestly, one of the first struggles, I would say, is being a bigger man in the world. It's hard to find shoes that fit you. It's hard to find clothes that fit you. And finding certain things that I liked that did not come in my size kind of pissed me off. So from that point forward, it's been this evolution of starting to kind of design my own clothing and to make my own clothing, and then kind of throwing that philanthropic type of vibe into that whole realm and that whole world of fashion. I came up with this brand that I started this past year called Public Immunity. And the basis of it is not just fashion and art and creation. It's all of those things that I have a passion for mixed with this whole giving back and trying to make a difference and a footprint in this world, and more or less to plant a seed, or to plant many seeds in the form of art and fashion and creation of any kind in this world, that hopefully years down the road, who knows how long, that seed will sprout and make a difference in somebody's life or the world.
Man, I like it. I like it a lot. I like it not only because of what it represents, but what it represents, right? You've got a passion for it, but it goes deeper than that. So are you selling this merch, or if people wanted more information, how would they get it?
Yeah, I have a website, publicimmunity.com or publicimmunity.shop. The way that the website is kind of set up is like an art museum type of thing. We got galleries and we got exhibits. The first exhibit, the theme behind it was racial inequality, racial injustice, so to speak. So we're wanting to, you know, make some ripples and make some waves and make a statement there around racial inequality. There are 7 galleries, I believe, throughout this exhibit. A couple have been released already. I think there is 2 or 3, maybe 4, that'll be left to debut throughout the earlier parts of 2021, and then going into the latter parts of 2021 into 2022. The next exhibit is going to be focused on mental health, and we're going to start to attack mental health this off season. And there's going to be a little bit of a rebranding, a new kind of website structure, and the whole vibe of the clothing and the creation. There's going to be some more art pieces and photography and whatnot that are going to be a part of those galleries, but it's going to be a whole different vibe from the clothing to the art to everything that we're trying to put out there into the world to make a difference.
Back to the phones. JJ, good to have you. JJ, how are you?
Hey, I'm great. Jimmy Jam, homie, my homie. How about those Chiefs? And, dude, I agree with you 100% about it. Coach Eric B. We love him, and we're going to miss him when he's gone, but we're going to stack championships while he's there. How nice, nice radio of Rick in Buffalo to wish Patrick Mahomes a speedy recovery. But was winter break too long? Are you going to sleep on the fact that Patrick Mahomes has a Super Bowl ring, that he's got championship game experience? Or what about the fact that he got a tank of a tight end named Travis Kelce, or the Chiefs cheetah, Tyreek Hill, or a honey badger that don't give a damn? Because what about week 6? We went into your shiny, up-and-coming city, and we beat you down. We'll do it again. There'll be 16,000 fans lined up at 6 a.m. or earlier, Jim. You've seen this. To tailgate, to be ready, to be at full throat, in the cold, at Arrowhead. I see this game, Kansas City 33, below 27. How about these Chiefs? Oh, sorry, Romy. This repeating championship thing is hard, dog. Watch out, Bills, because your ass in a war. This game's going to be dynamite!
JJ's dynamite! That phone call, I thought, ended 10 different times. He's probably still on the phone right now. Going, dynamite! Let's go to the phones. We go to New York. My guy, John. What's going on, John? What's up, brother?
Hey, John. Hey, Jim. I hope everything's all right with you and the fam. I just wanted to say it's an unfortunate circumstance and situation with that female reporter. I hope that she's able to recover and move about and get on with her life after that incident. But the thing I called about really, Jim, was James Harden. I've been wanting James Harden to come to Brooklyn for a long time, along with Kevin Durant. Nets fans can finally take the bags off of their heads and look at the TV again and watch basketball. Basketball is back in New York. Unlike that dumpster fire on 33rd and 7th Avenue, the Nets and Joe Tsai, thank you, Joe Tsai, for bringing a championship-caliber team back to New York and bringing the fans back to the TV to watch again. I'll go get cheesecake for James Harden, and I'll go get burner phones for Kevin Durant during halftime of the game, run across Flatbush Avenue Extension, Jim. This is a championship-caliber team. It was on display last night for the country. New York basketball is back, Jim. I'm not saying we're going to win the championship, but we're in the race again. Take the bags off your heads, Net fans. We're in it again. Thanks a lot, Jim, for your time.
My man, John in New York. Go ahead, Alvy. Rack him. Because I can.
Rack him!
Good night,